trying to get crystals, grow crystals for about 5 years, and we're failing, but we started using other biophysical methods, particularly fluorescence spectroscopy, to try to learn something about the protein dynamics. And what we found is that the receptor doesn't behave like a lot of soluble proteins, which are rather, you know, inflexible, that the receptor is highly flexible, and that flexibility prevents crystal formation. So we started to work on various ways to stabilize the protein. And ultimately, we obtained structures from a receptor stabilized by an antibody and by protein engineering. And those two, that work was done in the early 2000s, and it wasn't until 2006 that we had our first real crystals, and ultimately published these structures in 2007.
You're listening to Masterminds, where we sit down with experts in science and medicine to talk about everything, from the research of today to the innovation of tomorrow. This is Will.
And this is Mishka.
And today, I sat down with Dr. Brian Kobilka, professor in the Department of Molecular and Cellular Physiology at Stanford University School of Medicine.
Dr. Kobilka is an expert on a class of receptors called GPCRs that are essential in a majority of biological processes, including light, flavor, and odor perception, and in the activity of adrenaline, dopamine, and serotonin.
In fact, currently approximately half of all pharmaceuticals on the market target GPCRs. In the mid-1980s, Dr. Kobilka and his colleagues from the Robert Lefkowitz lab were the first to clone the gene for an important GPCR called the beta-2 adrenergic receptor, and later he and his collaborators were the first to determine its molecular structure, which served as the basis for understanding all subsequent GPCRs and creating drugs to target them.
This work proved to be revolutionary in many areas of science and medicine, such that in 2012, Kobilka was awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his contributions to understanding GPCRs.
In this interview, we talk about these amazing findings and the recent advances in understanding this important class of receptors. So we hope you enjoy this episode. To start off, what in your childhood do you feel led you into a career in science and eventually your specialty in physiology and structural biology?
I believe that, you know, I grew up in a small town, and I had friends whose fathers were physicians, and my own pediatrician just lived down the street, and I was a good friend with his sons. So I believe it had to do mainly with just the esteem that the community felt for these, you know, physicians. They were highly regarded. You know, there were people you would go to for help. And I thought I wanted that as a career. And this was before I necessarily thought about the interest in, the diseases and curing them and treating them. It was more of a respect for physicians in my community. That led, of course, to trying to prepare myself to be able to get into medical school. As I got older in high school, I was particularly interested in chemistry and biology. And then that was, you know, my choice in going to University of Minnesota Duluth was to prepare myself to get into medical school. And I think my interest in science, in the science of medicine, probably as a result of that, but not, you know, that was my driving force to become a physician.
And you got into medical school, and you were eventually a resident in internal medicine at WashU and Barnes Church Hospital. What was that experience like, and did you take any valuable lessons from your experience here?
Well, being a resident, intern and a resident is... It's a very tough life for a couple years, being on call every other night or every third. Some rotations were more relaxed than every fourth, but it's many hours, in the hospital, very little time outside. It's a very intensive learning experience, to prepare you for practicing as an independent physician. So It's kind of a blur. I mean, I just remember being tired a lot. Also, to some extent, being excited about the learning process and being able to treat people. And I would say my most interesting experiences were in the intensive care unit, where things happened fast. People were very sick. You got data very quickly, both labs and other kinds of data, and you could see the consequences of your interventions very quickly. And I would say that interest in intensive care medicine probably was the more or less the foundation for my basic science interest, because many of the drugs that we're giving patients in the intensive care unit were working on this family of proteins called G protein coupled receptors. Particularly, you know, we were giving drugs that worked on adrenergic receptors, both activators and inhibitors. And so this ultimately led me to an interest in intensive care medicine and for the future. And at the time, if you were interested in intensive care medicine, you either did a cardiology fellowship or a pulmonary fellowship. There weren't formal intensive care fellowships at the time. So I would say that more or less led me to applying to cardiology programs. And in particular, was interested in Duke because there was a faculty member there, Robert Lefkowitz, who was working on this family of proteins, particularly adrenergic receptors.
And what went into that decision to being very clinically focused to taking on a very heavy research career?
I don't think at the time that I started my fellowship in the Lefkowitz in at Duke, I don't think I had any kind of thought of a career in research. But what I did want is an experience in research that was more complex than I've had before. So I had some research experience at University of Minnesota Duluth, some at Yale, but they were very short descriptive projects. And it made me interested in research enough to try to explore it more. So when I went to Duke, the fellowship allowed you research time, generally anywhere from a year and a half to 2 years, which was much more time than I've ever had. And they actually offered the opportunity to do it up front. So and that made a lot of sense to me because, one, I was tired of being on call. I had two young children. I wanted to spend time with them. And it just seemed like, you know, a lifestyle would be better. I also thought that if I was going to become a practicing cardiologist, it might be better if I have my clinical training before I actually start my career as a cardiologist. So there's, no gap, and I would be clinically more well prepared. So that's how I ended up at Duke, and ending up in the lab of Robert Lefkowitz was a bit of a process. There are a number of different labs that I interviewed with. The Lefkowitz lab was huge. It was over 30 people. I never actually managed to keep track of how many people there were. They were mainly postdoctoral fellows. There were a few graduate students. And generally, he would have one token MD only. And the previous MD only had just graduated from the program. So there was a spot. Most people advised me against going to the Lefkowitz lab because it was just too big. I just didn't have enough experience and I would be lost. But I had two visits to Duke. Both times Bob Lefkowitz wasn't there, so I never really got to interview with him. But his colleague, Mark Carone, was, I spoke with him on a number of, on those two occasions. And he really made me feel like, even if you don't know what you need to know to start with, you'll learn. And the projects sounded very exciting. So That's how I ended up at Duke and in the Lefkowitz lab.
And as you mentioned, in the Lefkowitz lab, you focused on studying this type of G protein coupled receptor, the beta adrenergic receptor.
Right.
What was the status of our understanding of this class of receptors when you joined?
Well, so it was known at the time that there were a number of receptors that worked by activating G proteins. So G proteins had been identified and actually purified in it from a number of sources. Receptors, at the time I was there, receptors had been purified from different sources. It turns out that lung tissue, the beta 2 receptor is expressed highly in lungs, and it's the target for a lot of drugs to treat asthma and COPD. So the Lefkowitz lab had also purified the protein, but purified protein doesn't really tell you much about the structure. And the goal in the lab when I first joined was to get a clone of the receptor so we could actually determine the full amino acid sequence and begin to learn something about its structure at a higher resolution.
And that paper, which is very highly cited today, what went into the first cloning of the gene for that receptor?
Right. So when I first joined the lab, I wasn't so much involved in that project. That's the one I wanted to participate in. But again, I had no real skills. By the time I had joined the lab, they had obtained some peptide sequences from the purified protein, and they were using that in a collaboration with Merck Sharp and Dohme to screen cDNA libraries using what we call guest oligonucleotide probes. So, knowing codon bias for humans, knowing some peptide, you could generate a number of oligonucleotides to screen for cDNA libraries for the receptor. That was ongoing, and it wasn't that successful. The other option at the time was to screen using antibodies. So try to make antibodies of the for the receptor and use those to screen cDNA libraries. So that was the task they gave me, to try to make antibodies to the receptor. I failed. And after about a year, I asked if I could become more involved in the cloning. And I spent 4 weeks at Merck Sharp and Dohme learning from one of their scientists, Richard Dixon, how to screen libraries. So I came back and set up the molecular biology in the Lefkowitz lab, and we would help screen the libraries that were made for us by the Merck group. It was almost a year of trying and failing. And then we came up with the idea of screening not a cDNA library, but a genomic library. The reason that you generally don't do that is because genes are full of introns. And so you might pull out sequence of an intron, but it wouldn't give you the whole protein sequence. But we figured maybe it would just give us better probes. So I made a genomic library, and then we screened it and we sent it to Merck. They screened it, and we both found this clone in a relatively short period of time. So it was about 5 kilobases, and it contained the entire coding sequence. The beta 2 receptor, unlike most genes, had no intron. So it was very lucky. We got the full sequence out of a genomic clone.
And another important discovery from that paper was the homology to the rhodopsin gene. Can you explain why that fact is important?
So that perhaps shouldn't have been a surprise. But at the time, there were these two light-activated proteins, rhodopsin and bacteria rhodopsin. And so it was known that there was GTP binding proteins involved, but it was felt that these are light activated proteins, and they probably are different from other G protein coupled receptors. So although it shouldn't have been, in retrospect, it was a surprise that they're so similar. And it helped us to at least be comfortable in the first 2D structure. In other words, the topology of the protein having seven transmembrane domains.
And later on, you did this work that is considered your prize-winning work on the structure of the beta-2 adrenergic receptor. Can you tell the story of that discovery and some of the obstacles and that you had to overcome to figure that out?
Yeah. So that's a really long story. Shortly after getting the clone and then doing some structure activity studies with mutants, I began to really understand that to fully understand how this protein works, we needed a structure. I had no experience in getting protein structures or any of the actual experience needed to even begin crystallography trials. So the first challenge was to be able to make enough protein, pure protein. And I started my lab in 1990 with the goal of getting a crystal structure, not realizing how crazy that was at the time. But I just sort of struggled with different expression methods, finding the best way of making the receptor, modifying the ways of purifying it to improve the recovery of proteins from very different purification steps. And in about 1995, we had enough protein to begin crystallography trials. So you really need to be able to make milligram quantities of protein. And we could make, you know, 1 or 2 milligrams at a time. And we're trying to get crystals, grow crystals for about 5 years. And we're failing. But we started using other biophysical methods, particularly fluorescence spectroscopy, to try to learn something about the protein dynamics. And what we found is that the receptor doesn't behave like a lot of soluble proteins, which are rather, you know, inflexible, that the receptor is highly flexible, and that flexibility prevents crystal formation. So we started to work on various ways to stabilize the protein. And ultimately, we obtained structures from a receptor stabilized by an antibody and by protein engineering. And those two, that work was done in the early 2000s, and it wasn't until 2006 that we had our first real crystals and ultimately published these structures in 2007. And these were all inactive state structures. And again, because active states, agonist-bound structures tend to be even less stable than structures without any, or I'm sorry, agonist-bound receptors tend to be less stable than receptors bound to antagonists or nothing. So our next challenge was to find an active state receptor. And ultimately, we succeeded in obtaining the first active state by, again, antibodies from a llama. So llamas have these special antibodies that are smaller than our human antibodies. And these small antibodies are really good at binding to clefts in proteins and stabilizing certain states. So our first nanobodies gave us our first active state structure. And then at the same time, we were working to get a structure of a receptor coupled to a G protein, which would also likely be more stable. And that came a little after that in 2011. By 2000, end of 2011, we had inactive states, agonist bound states, and G protein coupled states.
And when you finally obtain a crystal for these different states of the receptor, how do you derive the three-dimensional structure of the protein from that?
So you use X-ray diffraction. One of the developments in X-ray diffraction technology that really helped us were pioneered by a competitor of mine named Gebhard Schertler. and it's called microfocus crystallography. So most crystallography done at the time on soluble proteins used an X-ray beam that was roughly 50 microns by 100 microns. So it's a kind of big oval. And most of the crystals were bigger than that. Our crystals were really small. Some were less than 50 microns. And the problem with using this very big beam on very small crystals is you have a lot of noise and very little signal. And Gephardt developed, and others in other synchrotron facilities as well, developed microfocus or microbeam crystallography, where the X-ray beams were around 10, even as low as 5 microns. And that was critical. Without that development and that technology, we wouldn't have been able to get, our crystals were just too small.
So now that at this point in history, you have the three-dimensional structure of the inactive, active, unbound, and active bound to the ligand. What do these three different structures tell you about the function of the receptor?
Well, they told us the major structural changes that have to take place in order to activate a G protein. And it pointed to one of the 7 transmembrane domains, transmembrane 6, which has to move out of the way so the G protein can engage. What we were hoping is to learn why a particular receptor will couple to a particular G protein. So there are roughly 800 different GPCRs, and there are roughly 16 different G protein types, and receptors tend to pick a particular G protein subtype. Surprisingly, that structure didn't provide that information. And subsequently, we now have hundreds of the structures of receptor G protein complexes, primarily through the use of cryo-electron microscopy. And we still don't really know, these structures don't tell us how to determine the G protein that a receptor will couple to from the sequence of the receptor. And what we've learned in this interval is that our structures represent the endpoint of a probably a process that requires intermediate states. And we've been able to identify these or at least identify that these states exist, but they're very they're unstable and they're transient, and therefore not amenable to structures by either crystallography or cryo-electron microscopy.
And another important point that you note in those original papers are that the importance of the of discovering the structure of the beta-2 adrenergic receptor is that it serves as a better template for understanding GPCRs compared to rhodopsin. Can you explain why that is?
Well, because it's a ligand-activated, a drug or a hormone-activated receptor. Rhodopsin has a covalently bound a molecule that, when activated by light, changes structure. But our receptors have to actually engage the drug first, binding on the outside to subsequently activate the receptor on the inside. The other thing that about rhodopsin is it's incredibly stable. And in the absence of any light, there's no G protein activation. And that's really important because if there is some sort of basal activity in the absence of light, we would, we would see a kind of a gray haze. Other GPCRs tend to have some basal activity. In other words, a beta receptor can activate G proteins even without an agonist, just at a very low level. And this is because of this dynamic character. So rhodopsin has much less dynamic character, and that's essential for its function.
I think at this point in the podcast, it would be helpful to give an overview of kind of the story of how GPCRs are activated. So the ligand binds, and what happens downstream of that? What is a G protein, and how does that cause downstream signaling effects?
Okay. Yes, would be nice to have a pictures here, but So a G protein is a cytosolic protein that has lipid tags on it so that it's generally localized to the plasma membrane on the inside of the membrane. It consists of three components: an alpha subunit, beta subunit, and a gamma subunit. The beta gamma subunits are tightly bound to each other and don't dissociate. Upon encountering an agonist activated receptor, the heterotrimeric G protein will engage the receptor, and the very C terminus of the alpha subunit can bind into the core of the receptor, and this space is made possible by the outward movement of TM6. So when TM6 moves outward, it creates a binding pocket for the C terminus of the alpha subunit, and that leads the alpha subunit to dissociate GDP. So when it's in the inactive conformation, it's GDP bound, and then GDP is replaced by GTP. And then the alpha subunit separates from the receptor and the beta gamma subunits. And both alpha subunits and beta gamma subunits can go on to modify various enzymes or ion channels in the cell and change behavior. They can ultimately lead to changes in transcription of various proteins. So once you get away from the plasma membrane, the signaling profile of any particular receptor G protein complex can get very complicated. And then this signaling continues until GTP is hydrolyzed by the G protein, and then the alpha and beta gamma subunits reassemble, and the cycle can begin again.
And I think that relates to another important paper that you published on the protein structure of the G protein. How did that happen? How did you figure that out? And how did that kind of change our understanding of how this receptor works?
Well, so the protein structure of the G protein alone was determined, in the 1990s by the Gilman group. So that wasn't, but what we determined was the structure of a G protein bound when it's bound to the receptor in the nucleotide free state. So we captured the very end of this activation process. Inside of a cell, the levels of nucleotides prevent this nucleotide free state from existing for very long. But what my colleague Roger Sunahara found is that if you have any nucleotide around, it's very hard to stabilize a receptor G protein complex. So almost all of the structures of receptor G protein complexes are obtained using an enzyme called a pyrase, which cleaves of all the GDP and GTP. Now, what we learned about the activated G protein is one, how the receptor activates by creating a pocket for the C terminal end of the alpha subunit. And what was also somewhat surprising is the alpha subunit consists of two domains: a RAS domain, which is the one that engages the receptor, and the alpha helical domain. And these two domains sandwich the guanine nucleotide. So when GDP is released, surprisingly, the alpha helical domain becomes very flexible. It actually completely dissociates from the RAS domain. And that flexibility, which we didn't know happened early on, but that flexibility made it more difficult for us to get crystals. Because as I mentioned, anything that's flexible is difficult to crystallize.
And I think a lot of our listeners who are likely pre-med majors at WashU know that learning about the structure is a very, it's such an important topic that it's a whole unit in introductory biology courses. But I'm curious, at the time that you and your laboratory figured this out, did it feel like it would come to as important of a status as it did, or did it feel like this was just another experiment?
I mean, I think we recognize that it was a major breakthrough, but at the same time, we knew there was still a lot of things we didn't understand. I think that people outside of the field some even asked me, well, you solved the mechanism of G-protein activation. What are you going to do next? But it turns out that, you know, for many reasons, there are still many things we need to learn. And we, as I said, we still don't understand what we call G-protein coupling specificity. And so at least for us moving forward, involved getting more receptors coupled to different G-proteins to see if what we learned for the beta 2 was applicable to other receptors and other G-proteins. And then recognizing that structure alone doesn't give you the entire story. And we've really been pushing on understanding protein dynamics and characterizing protein dynamics. And that's still an ongoing process in the lab.
And what are some of the broader roles of G-protein coupled receptors, and how has understanding their structure through your work helped us better characterize those in the context of physiology and medicine?
I believe that having structures definitely can facilitate drug discovery. So now it's possible, let's say if you're a drug company, you get you're interested in a particular target. Let's say, I mean, one of our favorite targets is the mu opiate receptor, which is responsible for the body's response to most opiate analgesics. It's also the target for many drugs of abuse. So if, let's say you develop a new drug, which appears to have better properties, you know, more analgesia, less adverse effects, but it's not high enough affinity, its potency is too low. You can get a structure of the receptor bound to that drug, and that might help you design modifications of the drug to improve its potency.
And you mentioned that you're still interested in figuring out how G-protein coupling specificity occurs. What are some of the other questions about GPCRs that you have that your lab is currently investigating?
Well, I wouldn't say that these are projects that my lab is very actively involved in, but one of the developments in the field over the past couple of years is localization of signaling. So for decades, we thought of the receptors on the plasma membrane, that they activate G proteins on the plasma membrane, and that the G protein activation leads to propagation of signaling throughout the cytoplasm. It's now known, and we've known for a while, that G proteins become internalized, and that's part of a process called desensitization. But it turns out that several GPCRs have been shown to continue signaling from these endosomal compartments, and often signaling in different ways. So plasma membrane signaling can differ from endosomal signaling. Also been shown to signal from the Golgi apparatus. So I think these are really interesting developments. As I mentioned, we're kind of, you know, bystanders, and I know several of my colleagues are very interested in this, but there are some aspects that we might explore as to why signaling is different from these compartments. And one possibility is that the lipid composition might be different in different compartments, and that differences in lipid composition could affect the conformation of the receptor. And so that's an area that we're really interested in, is the physiologic role of lipids and native lipids in receptor signaling. And it's particularly difficult because you really only find native lipids in cells. As soon as you break membranes open or break cells open, you lose the asymmetry. I mean, you still have the lipid composition, but plasma membranes and other membranes are asymmetrical. In other words, the outer leaf that contains a different composition of lipids than the inner leaflet. And we think all of those could, you know, play important roles in in how a receptor, how a receptor is activated and what it couples to. So that's a direction that we're exploring as well.
Your lab has also done a lot of work in characterizing other types of GPCRs other than beta 2 adrenergic receptors. How would you characterize the variety within GPCRs in both their functions and structure?
So I think the most different structure, different receptor class. So there are different families of receptors. The largest family is family 8, which contains about 700 of the 800. Then there are families B and C and D and F. The family C is most different in that is they're obligate dimers, and they have very large extracellular domains that bind small molecule ligands. So they include the metabotropic glutamate receptor, GABA receptors, receptors for taste, also belong to that family. And you know, the way they activate G proteins is also different from the way family A receptors activate G proteins. So this the obligate what we call the Venus flytrap motif, this very large extracellular domain, when bound by an agonist, causes the transmembrane domains to come close to each other. And then one of the two seven transmembrane domains will then activate a G protein, but in a different way than family A receptors activate the G protein.
And this body of work that you've produced throughout your career, eventually received recognition by the Nobel Committee. Could you tell the story of what was it like the morning that you got the call that you had been awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry?
It was very exciting. The phone call came, I think, around 2:30, and we just let it ring because we assumed it was a wrong number. And then it stopped, and then it started up again. So I got up and answered the phone. And for a while, I couldn't talk. My wife was there trying to find out what's wrong. So then after that phone call, within about a half hour, you're starting in phone calls from around the world, you know, news agencies. There's an office at Stanford that is ready to help with the, you know, sort of monitor the calls and help with that kind of traffic in that morning. And they came over. So the house, by about 3:30, the house was full of people, you know, people from news agencies and you know, just many phone calls.
How would you say being a Nobel laureate since then has changed your life?
Yeah, it definitely has changed my life. Part of the reason is you get invited to give talks throughout the year, throughout the world. And that's, you know, that's, you know, you feel, it's great to have that kind of recognition, but that much traveling can disrupt both your family life and your research career. I was lucky that my lab was pretty mature at the time, and, you know, people didn't need me as much as maybe they had previously, but I would say that was a bit of a downside, just managing my travel and but on the other hand, it was also an opportunity to see, you know, places that I would never have been able to travel. So, and, you know, there's some good and some bad. I wouldn't give up the prize, you know, knowing that, you know, there were some bad things involved, or not necessarily bad things, but things that were sort of counterproductive to the advancement of my research.
And another award that you received is from Villanova University, the Mendel Medal, which is recognition for scientific contributions that demonstrate the compatibility between faith and reason. I was curious how, if at all, has your faith guided your scientific journey or your life in general?
You know, I'm not sure that I have a really good answer for that. I think it's played a role, I think it's more played a role in how I interact with people and try to treat everybody with respect, whether they're brilliant postdocs or struggling students. I think it has more to do with that than actually the scientific outcomes of my research.
And what mentors throughout your training and career have been important in your formation as a scientist?
My first mentor was Conrad Ferling, a biology professor at UMD, University of Minnesota Duluth. And he was the one that, you know, offered me some time in his lab. And I spent probably three years, on a project. Every time I had some time, I'd be in his lab and working on this project. Then I guess the next mentor would be Bob Lefkowitz and Mark Caron at Duke. Plus, I would say there are a number of postdoctoral fellows who really helped me learn, the various techniques that I needed to learn. And they really didn't, they didn't get anything out of it. They were just very nice people who saw that I was struggling and helped me out. So I've been fortunate to have really good mentors throughout my career.
And my last question is a question that we ask all of our guests. Do you have any advice for young scientists and college students going forward in their careers?
Yeah, I always get this and I don't have a good answer. I would say that my career, I benefited from being at the right place at the right time, and not always planning ahead. I didn't really know about the Lefkowitz lab, but a friend of mine who had done some research, one of my fellow residents, pointed out that this was a potentially good lab for me. I came into the Lefkowitz lab at a great time in terms of the development of this cloning project, which allowed me to learn a lot of diverse techniques. I had the people in the lab who were very helpful for me. I'm not sure that I could have planned any of this. There was sort of tenacity. It took me 15 years to get my first goal accomplished. I think persevering is important. At some point, I became very interested in the question. And it probably the cloning was, I was just interested in succeeding at something challenging. But once I saw what the clone looked like in the receptor sequence, and I thought, I really want to know what this looks like in three dimensions. And so at that point, I would say, if I had a drive and a passion, that was it. And I was lucky that I was able to struggle with this for as long as I did, and ultimately be successful. But some people say, why didn't you give up? And one answer is that I knew that somebody had to be able to do it and I could eventually do it. The other answer is maybe I wasn't creative enough to come up with some other project. And all through this, through the crystallography, I had a lot of advice and help from both, friends, colleagues, and competitors, particularly the one I noted before, Gebhard Schertler, was, we were competing, yet he was also helping me. So that's the good part of science.
We appreciate how generous Dr. Kobilka was with his time, and this discussion was illuminating for how crucial discoveries in science occur.
Understanding the structure of GPCRs has proven to be extremely useful in medicine, but it is clear from Dr. Kobilka that there is much more to understand. Regardless, the function of GPCRs is an important unit in most college introductory biology courses, so it was awesome to hear how it was discovered by one of the people that discovered it.
I was also amazed by how humble Dr. Kobilka is regarding his immensely productive career and how he is really focused on teaching students to become great researchers.
If you like the Masterminds podcast, you can support us by following us on Spotify or subscribing on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Masterminds Pod. Please leave comments on any of our latest posts if there are any topics or guests you would like to include on future episodes. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on Masterminds.